Well, we are beginning a new series, as promised, in the book of James. And so if you have a Bible, I invite you to turn with me to James chapter 1. We'll start there. This should take us through the next 8 weeks or so. And so we will, there's five chapters in this letter in the New Testament. And James, if you're not familiar with it, is very, very practical. It deals with all kinds of issues like faith and prayer and speech and making plans and money and just really all kinds of things. It's actually been a bit of a controversy over the years, and we'll get into that more probably week three. Martin Luther actually didn't want James to be in the Bible, and so we'll talk about that week. I'm glad he lost that argument, but and not a funny joke there. James 4, what am I doing up here? Okay, James 4, verse 14 says this, "What is your life?" And I would say this is probably a summary statement of the book of James. What's your life? And it's dealing with faith. I mean, he mentions it 14 times in five chapters. What's your life about? And so we're going to walk through this. James chapter 1, verse 1. "James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings." Now, first a word on who wrote this, when it was written. Lots of discussion about this. There are three sort of primary contending Jameses that may have written this. One is James, the brother of John, one of Jesus' disciples. Another is James, son of Alphaeus, also a disciple, lesser known. But church tradition has it that this was actually, anybody know? James, the brother of Jesus, written sometime maybe around somewhere between 40 and 60 A.D., and really, I see no reason to even go on and on about this, but let's just assume it was James, the brother of Jesus. He's actually mentioned a few times in the New Testament by other writers. Paul, for example, in Galatians says, he says, "Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to get acquainted with Cephas," that's Peter, "stayed with him 15 days. I saw none of the other apostles, only James, the Lord's brother." So there is precedent for James and his role in the early church. He was considered the leader of the church in Jerusalem. And so all kinds of things here. If you go back to this verse, it says, "to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations." Acts chapter 8 talks about a time when Christians, Jewish followers of Jesus in Jerusalem, a persecution broke out. These people went from being leaders in the community, in the temple, to being ostracized, to being persecuted, and they scattered all over the place. Could be referring to that. That would be pretty early on in church history. Could be referring to AD 70 when Jerusalem was destroyed, and then people really were scattered then, and so people all over the place trying to figure out what it means to follow Jesus, what it means to live a life of faith in their various contexts, in their various challenges. Verse 2, he says this, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything." Kind of an interesting way to begin a book. Consider it pure joy when you face suffering, trials, difficulties, struggles, issues. Consider it pure joy. That's how I'm going to start this book. Of all the topics I'm going to raise, like right out the gate, no opening joke, monologue, no preamble. Just consider it joy when you suffer. Thanks a lot, James. That really makes it easy to walk through this. Again, not funny. What's this about? This phrase here when he says, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know the testing of your faith produces perseverance. This idea of testing of your faith, it actually in Greek has connotations of smelting. This idea that you take ore and you get an enormous heat applied to it, and basically the heat refines the pure metal, the gold, the silver, and the slag or the whatever, the invaluable elements are then burnt up or fall off, and only the pure metal, the valuable, precious metal remains. So this is kind of the idea when he talks about these testings produce something good within us. Now, James is addressing a group of people, Christians who find themselves in different parts of the world and largely who possess a worldview, the people around them, that says this. Good things happen to you because you're on the right track. Good things happen to you because you've got it together and you're pleasing the gods or God and you kind of deserve it. That's why these things are happening to you. And if bad things are happening to you, well, What'd you do? And what's your problem? You must have done something, and now the gods are mad at you, and they're paying you back. And so this is sort of the worldview, and James flips this, and he says, actually, when you're going through really difficult times, don't think, actually, this is an occasion to consider it pure joy. Now, a couple of thoughts on this. One is this. The visceral, like, gut emotion is still probably, like, sorrow, despair, anguish, anxiety. I mean, all perfectly natural things. He's not saying, I am so joyful, I'm suffering. He's not asking us to be masochistic about this. What he is saying is this. I want you to consider. Consider when trials come, when difficulties come. When, not if, by the way, and this happens to all Christians, no one is exempt from this. When these things come, it's actually not that God is mad at you. It's not that God has forgotten you. God is somehow, and we'll wrestle with this for just a minute, because it's not easy to get our arms around. God is somehow using these circumstances, and you can talk philosophically, did he cause them, or did he just merely allow them, or, you know, how does that all play out? It's probably another discussion. But the goal is that he would take you and me, and that as a result of this refinement process and the burning off of the impurities and the things that aren't valuable, that as a result of that, you and I would be more mature. You and I would be more complete. He uses this word that you would have perseverance. The Greek there is this idea of patient endurance. We don't really have a word for that. Patient endurance. That in a conscious, deliberate way, you and I would change, we would change our perspective. We would look at the possible results of suffering. Now, I know the immediate pushback, if we're listening, is this. Yeah, but you don't know my story. I mean, that's nice for people who have a stomach ache or people who can't get the, you know, weeds to stop growing in their driveway or those kinds of, you know, headaches and trials. Okay, but you need to hear my story. James, if you knew my situation, because my thing is kind of outside the parameters of what you're talking about, and I'm sure that's good, but in my situation, I'm not even sure you could say God is involved, let alone like working to bring something good out of this, working to bring something good in my life. Now, there are a lot of really, really great things about living in America, a lot of great things about living in this time, in this place, some of the things that we might be celebrating today, for example. But on the other end of the spectrum, our culture, American culture, is terrible when it comes to dealing with difficulty. When it comes to helping prepare people to deal with suffering, tragedy, you know, whatever it is. We're really bad about this. Actually, this is a modern kind of invention with modern times, and there are other cultures that are similar to ours in this, but for most of history here, it's been like this. For most of history, people have had this idea of, yeah, I'd like happiness, I'd like love or success or whatever the thing is. I hope for that, and if I can get it, that's great. You know, there's nothing wrong with those things. But if I don't, because I also recognize that life can be cruel and life is short and it can be really nasty sometimes, if I don't, I'm still going to live in such a way so that like the next life or the next time around or whatever the culture worldview was, that I can hopefully attain those things. We're the first culture in modern times, probably post-Enlightenment times, that says this is all there is. I mean, that's the definition of a secular society. This is it. What you see is what you get. If you don't find love, you've lost it all. If you don't find happiness, there is no consolation if you don't get it here and now. And so that's one of the tensions that we, as citizens of another kingdom, that we wrestle with. And we're always going to wrestle with that because we're here and culture surrounds us and it's invisible and we can't see it and it really molds us in ways we're not aware. It's like asking a fish, you know, how's the water? I don't know. I don't even know it's there. And so in many ways, we deal with this tension of our worldview because it's all around us. And James is saying this, which I would say offends many of our Western sensibilities. He says that through trial, through difficulty, through adversity, God wants to develop something in you that he cannot do in any other way. I realize God works through good things. You know, you go on a mission trip, as we were talking about, or, you know, you become a new parent and your eyes are opened, you know, in ways to things. You have a challenge and yeah, it's difficult and yeah, there's work, but you're excited about it and it's a good thing and God's working. But more often than not, and how often is this true in your life? God uses the difficult things to form us, to shape us, to mold us. He would say here, to mature, to complete us. Has that been your experience? The things that, and I'm not even saying you look back on them and you go, hey, that was really hard, but I'd go back and you know, now we laugh about it. And sometimes not. Maybe you wouldn't go back and do it all over again. I'm just saying that God often uses these difficult things, things we would never sign up for, to form us and to shape us. See, the thing is for me and my wrinkle-free life I'm trying to kind of maintain, going after those things, it's like, God, you do your thing, and I'll do mine, and you know, we both keep to the right, and we'll stay out of each other's way, and everything will be fine. But you know this, when the bottom drops out, when you get the phone call, when you get the email, when there's a reversal, or there's a health issue, or a relationship that breaks, or the boss calls you into our office and tells you, you know, when those moments happen, it's a total game changer, isn't it? And that's the kind of, okay, God, you know, I realize this is going on, but like, I will get better, right? You know, like, okay, it's a season, I'm going through this, but like, in the end, it's all going to come back around, I'm going to come out on top, right? Like, this will work out eventually, right? We have these questions, we have these struggles, and James is saying that the very circumstances that have the potential, the power to destroy your faith, to push you away from God, that if you will let him, God has a way of leveraging these very situations to grow your faith, your confidence in him, to grow in your relationship with God. James is arguing that there are facets of a believer's character that could not exist without difficulty, without trial. Now, I don't like this any more than anybody here. And in fact, I'd probably choose not to talk about it if it didn't, James 1, verse 2, you know, here we go. And so I'm with you in this. How many of you, the people that you respect, the people that you go to for like counsel, the people that you really kind of hold up and like, I want to end up like that. I would bet with many of those people, they've been through difficulty. That what gives them that wisdom, what gives them that insight, what gives them that understanding of themselves and that awareness or that humility or that ability to empathize with you in your situation, or that ability to be so careful with other people, you know what that comes from? That comes from difficulty. That comes from facing adversity head on, and instead of running, instead of downward spiral, instead of, you know, all these other directions we could take it, they actually allow God to develop something, patient endurance within them, and develop their character. Look at James 1, verse 5. He goes on. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. This idea of asking for wisdom, which probably could be applied like a blanket, you know, in general kind of thing. In this context, though, he's talking about our adversity. He's talking about our trials. And he's saying this, when you go through these things, you know, perspective, it helps. And that's what wisdom is, isn't it? It's having the best possible perspective on a situation, on a difficulty. So ask God, who obviously has the best perspective. In other words, prayer in these difficult times may be the only thing that has a chance of aligning our perspective and saying, you know what, God, I don't know where this is coming from. I can't see, you know, two steps in front of me, but please help me to see this from your perspective. Help me to have your attitude, your approach to this, and I'll take it a day at a time. And then in verse 6, but when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. Those who doubt should not think they will receive anything from the Lord. They are double-minded and unstable in all they do. This idea of doubt, again, in context here, this is not referring to psychological uncertainty. You know, you're praying and it's like, oh, was that a doubt? Oh, that might have been a little tiny doubt. Uh-oh. You know, I'm blowing around here. That's not mental. It's not a mental thing. He's a much bigger, higher level argument that he's making here. He's saying this, and he actually says later in verse 8, doubt, it's really this double-mindedness. He's saying, do you have divided loyalties? And it's a really pretty ingenious argument. He's making this. He's making this statement. Are your loyalties divided? Because it's really easy when things are going well to say, yep, I'm passionate about God. I'm following him. I give my life to him. I want to glorify him. It's really, really easy in those moments. But when the rug is pulled out from underneath you, suddenly we find out what's really going on. Like when we lose the relationship, we lose whatever it was we thought we had, and suddenly we realize this thing, you know, God and my happiness, and these circumstances are kind of tangled up and they're kind of mixed up. He's saying, are you divided in your loyalty? It's probably a good idea with this to think about this ahead of time. And I think that's kind of the funny part about this. It's not like you go into it and just go, okay, I'm going to not doubt. No, who are you? What's at your core? Do you have divided loyalty? Because that what he's saying is that's going to come out in these moments. And you will know quicker than any other moment, quicker than any other sort of fuel, you'll know what exactly is going on the inside. Jesus talks about the foundation of our life, what it's built on. Is it built on rock? Is it built on sand? And it's in these moments of trial, in these moments of adversity, when like the sand, the loose stuff is eroded away, and we thought we were here, and we realize, ugh, I'm kind of hobbling here, I'm kind of tottering, and things aren't nearly as stable as I thought they'd be. And it's an opportunity, James is saying, to consider a different perspective, to get that thing like pushed back a little further. And when the next time comes, because it will come again, to push back a little further. And we probably never get it all the way there, but it's a continual process, a continual maturing, a completing that God is doing in us through our circumstances. C.S. Lewis says this, and it's a long quote, but I assure you it is worth it. He says this in The Problem of Pain, a great book, by the way, on this whole topic of evil and pain and suffering and where does it come from. He says, my own experience is something like this. I am progressing along the path of life in my ordinary, contentedly fallen and godless condition, absorbed in a merry meeting with my friends for the morrow, or a bit of work that tickles my vanity today, a holiday or a new book, when suddenly a stab of abdominal pain that threatens serious disease, or a headline in the newspapers that threatens us all with destruction, sends this whole pack of cards tumbling down. At first, I'm overwhelmed, and all my little happinesses look like broken toys. Then, slowly and reluctantly, bit by bit, I try to bring myself into the frame of mind that I should be in at all times. I remind myself that all these toys were never intended to possess my heart, that my true good is in another world, and my only real treasure is Christ. And perhaps, by God's grace, I succeed and for a day or two become a creature consciously dependent on God and drawing its strength from the right sources. But the moment that threat is withdrawn, my whole nature leaps back to the toys. I am anxious, God forgive me, to banish from my mind the only thing that supported me, God, under this threat because he is now associated with the misery of those few days. Thus, the necessity of tribulation is only too clear. God has had me for but 48 hours, and then only by dint of taking everything else away from me. In the last slide, let him but sheathe that sword for a moment, and I behave like a puppy when the hated bath is over. I shake myself as dry as I can and race off to reacquire my comfortable dirtiness, if not in the nearest manure heap, at least in the nearest flower bed. And that is why tribulation cannot cease until God either sees us remade or sees that our remaking is now hopeless. Wow, huh? Yeah, whole new perspective. I think the brilliant part of what James is saying is this. Adversity is not a sign that God is absent, which is where our minds usually go. Trouble comes, and our immediate thought is God must be abandoning me, forgot about me, doesn't care about me. To the contrary, James is saying this, adversity is actually a sign that God is active in your life, actually a sign that God is present, that for some reason God is using that, and when the bottom drops out, the good news is God is working in your life. I know the immediate thought is I wish he'd go work maybe somewhere else for a little bit, but it is what it is. It's God faithfully working in our lives, using, not causing, I believe, using our circumstances to complete us, to draw us closer to him. And Paul says things like this along the same lines as James in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. He says, we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not me. Verse 8, we are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed but not in despair, persecuted but not abandoned, struck down but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. And then down to verse 16, he says, therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles, By the way, for a reference point to what those light and momentary troubles are, see verses 7 through 9, basically. Though outwardly we are wasting, verse 17, for our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. I'm losing things, I'm facing trials, but I'm gaining something that lasts forever. Back to James 1, just a couple more verses. Verse 12, it says, blessed are those who persevere under trial, because when they have stood the test, they will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. When they've undergone this refinement process, when they've gone through this adversity, when they've seen their way by God's grace through these trials, they will receive that crown. Look, I know that circumstances and sometimes really horrible things, I know that when you ask people who used to be Christians who left the faith, that's one of the reasons that is often given, like, hey, I used to believe, but then this happened, and how could there be a God? And I realize that people walk away. I realize, and I can imagine scenarios that if they happened to me in my world, I fully admit I have no idea. I have no idea what that would do to my faith. I have no idea where I would end up, you know, down the road from that. You know what's more fascinating to me? What's more fascinating to me are the people that I know and that I've encountered as a pastor, and I'm sure you've encountered in your life, people who've been through like incredibly difficult things. And instead of going the opposite direction, instead of pushing further away from God, have somehow, as a result, and maybe it's taken time, and maybe it was a process, but have somehow, through that time, grown closer to God. And they would look back on that, and they would recognize God didn't cause that, but throughout the process, I realized that God is still good, that he is still faithful. They maintain their confidence and their trust in spite of their circumstances. Those people are amazing to me. Those people are an inspiration to me. You know the one difference, the one thing that determines, at least in my experience, whether or not people going into serious adversity, whether or not they're going to walk away, or somehow mysteriously, paradoxically grow closer to God. You know the one difference is that at least I've observed? It's who we surround ourselves with, who we listen to, who's in our life, and surrounding ourselves with people that give us perspective and not just, you know, try to smooth it out and try to give pat answers. That's not what I'm talking about. Most of the time when you see people who've walked away, they haven't surrounded themselves by good counsel, the church, people to encourage, people to support, people to lift them up. And those same things, and you can find people in the same situation. That same thing that can destroy a person's faith in one case can actually drive somebody, build their faith, their confidence up. It's the most amazing thing in a completely different situation. Let's look at the last part of James and we'll wrap this up. This is James 1:16. He's concluding this whole section of thought about trial and difficulty. Remember, he's writing people who are encountering kind of pagan cultures who believe you got to appease the gods or else, and they're constantly living with this threat looming over their head, and did I do enough, and what if it's not enough, and this bad thing must be because I didn't do enough. And so he says this in verse 16, "Don't be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows." In other words, God is not capricious. God is not like moody. You don't have to figure out, okay, what mood's he in right now? I got to approach him the right way. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. So God is bigger than that. He's actually doing something in you and in me that proves to the world that this is the beginning of what will one day be the ultimate redemption of the world. That it begins in our hearts, that we are the first fruits. And the thing that I hope that we walk away with, the first thing is this: adversity is a sign that God is present in your life. That doesn't mean he's not present if things are going great. I'm just saying, particularly in those moments, God is at work. And the other thing I hope we take away from this is this: the message of Christianity, the message of the cross that Jesus, for the joy set before him, endured the cross. The message is not, he's not saying that, I gotta get this right, sorry. Ah, yes. This is important. That's why I want to say this. The second thing I want you to get is this. The message of the cross is that redemption comes not in spite of suffering. Not like, okay, there's suffering and there's, you know, but somehow maybe we'll make it through it and maybe we'll be redeemed. The message of the cross is redemption comes not in spite of suffering, but it comes through it. It's the way it was designed. That's the message of the cross. We sang that hymn earlier, It Is Well With My Soul. And as we wrap this up and we think about what this means for your story and maybe what you're going through, the adversity, the trial, the difficulty that you're facing, I want to watch this video. And if you don't know the story behind the hymn, It Is Well With My Soul, this gives huge insight and I think adds another layer of depth and meaning and applies directly to this passage. So let's watch this.
When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrow like sea
brings a whole new meaning to that line for me when he writes, when sorrows like sea billows roll, and we think about the context of that. And I love how he's able to be honest about that and then kind of bring it around to the end. And Lord, haste the day when faith will be sight. In other words, this perseverance, this patient endurance will give birth to like reality, ultimate reality. May that day come quickly. I want to invite you to stand. We're going to sing another song that deals with this theme a little bit, and I want to give you this one last thought. You know this is true because you know this is true in all your other relationships. The greatest compliment you can pay another person is by maintaining your faith, your confidence in that person, in spite of the circumstances. And the greatest compliment I can pay to you is to say, look, I don't understand, I'm sure, and I love, but listen, because of your character, like, I trust you. I maintain my confidence in you. I think that's similar in our relationship with God, that when we don't have answers, when we don't fully understand, and maybe it's in these moments when we say, but God, you are still God, you are still good, I still trust you because of your character, because of who you are. Those moments might be the purest moments of worship. Those might just be, in those moments, the purest expressions of praise, to say, in spite of this, I still trust you. I still believe you are good. Let's sing together. Actually, let me pray. Lord, I can only imagine that that there are those of us here who are like, yeah, but you don't know my story. You don't know my circumstance. I'm just not there. I just don't see it. I just don't see where God is in that. Father, my prayer for those people here, for those of us who are in that situation, would be that you would give wisdom. Like today, you would bring maybe a new perspective, that you would help us to consider the situation from a different angle. That we'd be able to somehow consider it joy, maybe not at an emotional level, but at something far deeper. God, help us to endure. Help us to develop patient endurance, perseverance. God, help us when our difficulties come. If we're not going through them right now, we can be assured we will face them in the future. Help us just to be faithful. Help us to trust that you are good. Help us to be open to the work that somehow through the circumstances you want to do in our hearts, in our lives. It's in Jesus' strong name we pray. Amen.